Thank you for tuning in to PolitiTalk with Lane Palmer. Today we have a very special guest, Delia Krupp. Delia is a stage actress and screen artist, as well as an advocate for trans people. After graduating college with a triple major in theater, psychology, and English, Delia continued her education at the Drama Studio of London. Delia has been acting professionally for more than 40 years. I met her in person while she was making history portraying Charlotte von Malsdorf in Dog Wright's Pulitzer and Tony Award-winning play, I Am My Own Wife. In 2008, she was awarded the Lepin Leadership Award for services to the LGBTQ community. Delia is now an artistic associate and a board member of About Face Theater Company in Chicago. Her new initiative, Brave Conversations, looks at the significance of personal identity and ways to constructively talk about gender. On screen, she stars in the film Landlocked, debuting in the Indie Festival circuit in early 2021. Please welcome Delia Krupp. Thank you so much, Delia, for being on. It is such an honor to have you. You were one of my first guests that I had in mind when making this podcast. And of course, obviously, as I said, I had met you in 2016 when I was job shadowing you. So as always, when we start off, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to have the political mindset that you do.
Yeah, sure. Well, you got kind of my theater background there already. So, I was born and raised in Lansing, Michigan area back in the 1950s and raised in the 60s back when the auto industry was really at its strongest. And, probably the vast majority of jobs were either directly linked to Oldsmobile and GM at the time, or indirectly in terms of shops that made sub-assemblies. So economically, that area depended entirely on, I guess there were three centers, mostly the auto industry to some degree, since it's the state capital is there, you had, you know, some government workers. And then over in East Lansing, there was Michigan State University, which with over 40,000 students was, you know, something of an economic powerhouse. But and I was raised Union Democrat, blue, you know, Union blue, so to speak. And very much a working class type of liberal situation there. My dad was a member of the Communication Workers of America as an employee of Bell Telephone, and I'm not entirely sure why my household ended up being relatively liberal, other than just the fact, you know, that union people are, you know, they've got this thing where you think about the other person. And, you know, you have power in, as a group and in unity rather than, you know, screw the other guy, you know, just get everything for yourself sort of attitude that seems to profit the people going into management more. There's my socialist cry. and in high school, which would be like 1970 through 74, I went door to door for some local congressional campaigns, and I was a political cartoonist. Originally, I was going to go into art. Yeah, so I got these political cartoons that are like the size of an entire piece of poster board that feature, of course, back then it was Nixon and Ehrlichman. It was all the Watergate crew, basically, and that was pretty good, actually, I thought, but went to Boys State, and I was the cartoonist for the school newspaper. And I graduated, you know, fourth in my class. So I did people had really high hopes for me based on my abilities. And I got into college and I just, you know, decided that art wasn't my thing. I needed a collaborative, creative thing. I'd already spent my entire life up to that point in a room by myself, staring at an empty easel. And I wanted to, I had done some plays in high school, and I'd gotten cast in a lot of shows at Michigan State. So went from there and, you know, over to the Drama Studio. But politically, the 70s were kind of really weird, because you got this sort of George, of course, the Watergate was probably the seminal influence. you know, which is to say my particular generation, born in 56, I would be, I guess, a late boomer, right? I grew up with an extreme distrust and skepticism about power structures, particularly around the Republican Party, and we have not been disappointed in the subsequent decades, I must say. So, for reasons that had nothing to do with his leadership, Jimmy Carter, you know, got the bum rush and only got one term in. And I just despised Reagan. I despised him even before he was elected. I mean, it was like a Trump situation. Like, nobody would vote for him. You know, he's a laughing stock. And even though he had time as governor of California, I was like, no, you know, too old, too inexperienced. Yeah, he got elected because in the 1980s, what apparently a significant plurality of Americans wanted was to be told how great they were, as opposed to, you know, we need to work on this. You know, it's the curse of the progressives, you know, is that things are never quite good enough, because it isn't, you know, there's lots of improvements to make. And so they take a stance that doesn't strike people as, you know, people that need the rose-colored glasses and need the affirmation. God knows that's the only thing that Reagan could do, you know, do his shining city on a hill speech one more time. And it's like, oh. And in the meantime, of course, you know, you're probably too young to have been alive then, but you certainly know that he completely ignored the beginnings of our plague and probably millions of people needlessly died of AIDS simply because he didn't get the United States involved in it soon enough. We lost practically his entire presidency, you know, 8 years. And Bush, you know, was very tepid after that. Bush won. So, yeah. And then, of course, I was also witness to the kind of cultural sea change that happened in the 80s, too. When even the people that were, you know, in the arts or in the, you know, that were relatively democratic, liberal, they all decided, well, yeah, we need to make some money. And it really did happen like that. Not so much in the theater community, because theater people know that they're not going to make any money for quite a while. But, there was the house, the property flipping and the investing and all the stuff that you read about in history books. That really did happen. And it was part of a whole cultural thing where Reagan made it okay to be selfish, basically. I mean, that sounds really simplistic, but it's absolutely true. And so by the time we finally got Clinton in office in 92, I was like, God, at last. And at that time, we didn't really understand that Democrats could be just as archly neoconservative as Republicans could. And of course, Bill showed his true colors there. He did a few things, I guess. I'd have to go on Google and look them up, you know, that were positives. But certainly the information revolution took off under him. You know, he did what was necessary, you know, he made conditions good for us, for the economy, which we find. It always works that way, you know. The Republicans always sell themselves as being the economic powerhouse party, and they're not, you know. The fiscal deficits go up, and the earnings go down, and, but at any rate, and all along, I've just had more of a focus on, I think, people, other people, than just my own personal concerns. It was only a year, and it was only England. It wasn't like, you know, I've been to other continents, but, you know, living abroad, it really does change your perspective. It changes your perspective, first of all, on how other countries view you. Because when you're raised in America, you know, I mean, our shit doesn't stink. I mean, it's, and you get over abroad and you're finding that very intelligent people in, you know, very advanced Western countries have really unpleasant things to say about the American economy, the American character, and our culture. And kind of opened my eyes a little bit in that regard. But then once I started transitioning, which was, God, I was I didn't even know I was transitioning when it started. When I was about 47, I was about 50 before I realized that something's happening here. And then, of course, you know, you do the thing that always happens to trans people. You experience what it's like to be a minority. Because I didn't even identify as queer in any way, shape, or form. I'd been married to women and everything before the transition. So how you basically go down the status ladder, you know, white male, boom, right at the top to, boom, you know, right near the bottom as a trans person. So that was, it still is, you know, a big part of what my politics are related to is that this, you realize, I mean, starting with the 50% of the people that are female, but you also realize how many people, just by virtue of their ethnicity or the country that they may have been born in originally, or their gender identity or their physical abilities, are just not treated the same as other Americans. It's terrible. And in many cases, it's even lethal. Yeah. So that, in a nutshell, a big nutshell, I guess, is my political.
No, and thank you for sharing that. Honestly, you've hit on so many topics that I kind of echo, because again, I think a big part that has shaped my political mindset is the time that I was studying abroad and seeing how things work in Germany, and just wanting that kind of... that efficiency here. Why can't we have, like, you know, efficient bullet trains to get us between Columbus and Chicago in 3 hours? You know, why can't we have, you know, healthcare for everybody? Why can't, it's so frustrating, but you touched on a lot of great things. So one of, I think, the main talking points of Republicans that I hear a lot of the time, unfortunately, in terms of giving, minorities or people, especially in the LGBTQIA community, you know, certain rights and privileges, is that we are such a small minority in the country. Why should they pass laws that don't benefit the majority of Americans? That's kind of an argument I hear a lot. What do you say to that when Republicans kind of respond in that kind of manner, that they're like, oh, we should only focus on policies that target the majority of Americans as opposed to the minority?
Well, actually, they usually say something even more insidious than that. The first thing generally that a conservative will do is deny that there is any inequity to begin with. Mm. And then when you point out the reality of things to you, and you have to get really good at it, you know, going down your bullet points, you know, then they'll go, yeah, then the argument that you put forward, you know, that you mentioned might be put forward, but the one thing that's not even so, like, catering to the majority, which of course would be a pretty conspicuous racial code talk, what they generally will say is meritocracy. And there's been a lot of coming to light surrounding the concept of meritocracy in this last year. The primary thing being, of course, is that you cannot have a meritocracy until all people have equal opportunities at education and healthcare and everything else that goes into the making of a human being by the time you graduate from school and enter the workforce. It's an easy argument to make, you know, against the everything is really equal thing. What's harder to make, it's harder for people to realize is that it's a generations deep thing. I would have been, I was the first person in my family to go to college in 1956, going back as many generations as we could find, you know, nobody had gone to college. And even though, you know, there was a kind of a culture that education was vital, it's not the same as when your parents have been to college. Not the same at all. Mm-hmm. And then if you consider you may be from an ethnicity where also, you know, nobody had gone to college, maybe English wasn't the primary language, maybe your parents are forced to work like two or three or four jobs just to support you. Forget you know, sending you to school, you know, to college, then that's a huge inequity, because then you not only have a lack of immediate resources of money, basically, but you don't have necessarily, you know, the same value system behind education, or simply how to negotiate the education, the higher education. It's crazy. So there's all kinds of privilege that stand behind the people that say we should do everything on merit. And it's like much privilege that they don't even realize they have.
Yeah. So back when I first met you, it was 2016. And the election had not yet happened. I think we were about a month out, if I'm not mistaken.
No, actually, the election happened 2 days before we opened.
Oh, yes, yes. So, because I had met you.
You were on the rehearsals. Yeah. So we hadn't actually had them yet, right?
Right. So I came in October or early November, and we hung out. And
yep, exactly.
Obama was still president.
Yes, it was a different world.
I don't think I was connected with you on social media at that time. What was your response to the 2016 election results?
Well, honestly, my response was that I was in a play that where the character basically forged a life as a transgender person through the two most repressive regimes in Western history, through the Nazi occupation and then later through the communist Russia takeover, the Stasi, you know. And it suddenly felt that real life was getting to be just like my character's life in the play. Because Trump had by that point had already made it very clear where he stood on the queer community, on the, on immigrants, and many, many other things. And that, you know, we were going to become to some degree a fascist country for the next 4 years. And here I was every night acting out a character, you know, that first, well, Nazism were fascists, and I can't say that the communists were any better, but there were certainly two totalitarian regimes. And sure enough, by the end of the 4 years, Trump got us pretty darn close to the reality that I was portraying on stage. I made a point to mention that, too, when I was interviewed or asked about the experience, because I was scared. I was really scared. The show closed before the actual inauguration of Trump, of course, but... Mm-hmm. We could see what was coming.
Oh yeah, oh yeah, and that's why honestly the January 6th incident of this year didn't really surprise me at all. I mean, you know, for everybody who has seen Handmaid's Tale, all you know is it takes a handful of senators to get hung outside of the little, you know, post that they made outside of the Capitol to really start that fascist train to going. But yeah, it was interesting. I was reading a lot of articles about historians and the fact that usually most countries, when they start going down that road of fascism, they actually don't get out of it. And the fact that we were able to get Biden in there is kind of a testament to how at least our fundamentals of our country kind of protect us a little bit more. We'll see what'll happen next election cycle, unfortunately. But yeah, so what was your response then to the 2020 election? Were you concerned at all that Biden may not have been able to pull this out, or?
Yeah, I was very concerned because it was very clear at that point that even though the majority of voters, a small majority of voters, you know, were willing to vote for Biden and would probably even show up, which was our big problem in 2016, just poor voter attendance, I think, really, that, you know, that the Republicans were doing some really illegal things, you know, in terms of voter suppression, in terms of possibly even miscounting the ballots or fighting, you know, late ballots and other totally legal mechanisms there, you know, to basically steal it, you know. Well, the really interesting thing about the Trump Republican group is that they are masters of projection. Whatever they are doing that's illegal or immoral or just nasty, they immediately say that's what the other people are doing. Mm-hmm. It's protection. You know, I don't know if you've ever read, what was his name? Eric Hoffer. And I can't remember the name of the book, but he basically coined the term the big lie. Because, of course, he wrote that book right as World War II was finishing up, and he had witnessed, you know, several fascist regimes. And I said, yeah, the easiest way to make the most convincing lie that a totalitarian person can tell the people is the big one. Because if it's a small lie, you know, that you can easily footnote and, you know, say, no, that's not right, then it's easier to disprove. Mm-hmm. If you turn right around and say something that's 180 degrees from the actual situation, it just stuns people. They don't even know how to respond. And that's exactly what happened to Trump. If you remember 2016, people were like going, oh, that's ridiculous. It's such a bald-faced lie. I don't even want to just, you know, you can see it in Hillary Clinton's face. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, I'm not going to address the stupid things that are coming out of this guy's mouth. But the fact is, there was enough people that did believe it. Mm-hmm. And all these lies, these 180 degrees from the truth lies that they've told about us and about the state of the country and the state of other countries, there were too damn many people that believed them. Mm-hmm. And that's dangerous. I mean, that's gaslighting, you know? That's mm-hmm. basically what it is when you purposely alter the reality of the situation for personal or political gain. That's gaslighting.
Yeah. No, I remember even speaking with friends who were in Europe and in Asia, and they were like, Lane, how do you feel about the Democrats stealing this election? And I'm like, what are you talking about? And they're like, well, we've saw on the news that Donald Trump said the election is rigged, and
after 4 years, your friends believe what Donald Trump said?
Well, okay. Here's the thing. I think they believed him because he was the leader of the free world, right? In the free world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you can't trust your leader, who can you trust? Like, maybe they wouldn't have believed all the other things that they, you know, that he had said. But in terms of the election, you know, trying to look like, oh, he's making lawsuits, so this must be legit. Like, you know, looking at the evidence of what he was able to do legally. And you're right. It's very gaslighty. And of course, all of those lawsuits ended up amounting to nothing. And Yeah,
it's really hard when there is no standard for truth and reality. Mm-hmm. And I can understand why it kind of took them off guard at first, but the media, the press, particularly the news journalists, it was their responsibility to go, okay, here we have a candidate, and 80% of what comes out of his mouth is absolute lies. We're either not going to cover him, or we're going to catch him at every... And it made their life more difficult. Whereas, if they just let him do the lies and, you know, do the blatant privilege stuff, they would get lots of clicks. And because he's like, you know, this train wreck heading towards the White House. Mm-hmm. So there was no incentive for the media to do the right thing.
Right.
And that is unforgivable. Because they exist as the fifth estate or whatever to actually act as a check. You know, that helps guarantee our freedom. Mm-hmm. And they failed. Mm-hmm. They failed bad. Mm-hmm. And I think that when you actually talk to any individual journalists, mm-hmm. you know, even right up into and including anchors, they'll admit that. Mm-hmm. Some of them already have a bit of that. I mean, the ones like Dan Rather that are no longer having to pull a paycheck from their employer, you know, mm-hmm. they've been the first ones to say, you know, that the truth has to be guarded. The truth is a precious thing, particularly in a democracy. And to me, that was the biggest casualty of those 4 years was the truth. Because then, once the truth is dead, then all kinds of freedoms are gone, all kinds of injustices happen. And we're going to be, oh God, we'll probably be 20 years undoing some of the nasty things that Trump has done. Mm-hmm. You know, to this country.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and as we were even speaking before we began recording, you know, talking about the Reagan presidency and how, you know, my generation is still reeling from the effects of what happened with, you know, that. Power begets power, and if we don't keep it in check, as you've said, we will face the consequences for a lifetime to come. What do you think then of organizations like Fox News? I mean, obviously, you know, I can assume your opinion on them, but how do we counter that? How do we fix that? How do we address that?
Well, there was some legislation in and I can't even tell you whether the truth doctrine or something like that, where there were actual, there was an actual bar of veracity, of truth that you had to meet in order to be considered an actual news organization. Mm-hmm. At some point, that law was struck down, and I don't even know if that law had enough teeth in it right there and then. But yeah, basically, I mean, Jesus, we have a license for everything else. Why don't we have a license for organizations that are actually news? I mean, actually test them. How do you research things? How do you keep things fair? You know, what are your credentials or background? I mean, on their background, Fox would be thrown out of the business right there for all their lies and history of deception. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and if we're not going to do it from a professional standards, you know, where the industry polices itself, then by God, you know, we need to have some sort of not a government organization, but some sort of third standard, mm-hmm. you know, like the kind that, you know, oversee the quality of your electronics and things like that, you know, a standards group.
Yeah.
And that you can't call yourself news if you don't meet that. Yeah. I mean, Fox would be drummed out of it overnight. MSNBC, I think, would just have to change their practices. They know how to do it. They're simply meeting a huge need based on, you know, the fact that Fox exists.
Yeah.
there needs to be the exact opposite, you know, out there as well. Yeah, I don't know any other way to do it, because we've seen that when there is no commercial incentive to tell the truth and respect reality, when that disappears, then so does reality, and that's a precious thing.
No, I love that. I love that. Having an independent organization to look over it, I think that is definitely the way to go. Another aspect of you that I truly admire is the fact that you are such a fierce, fierce advocate for other members of your community. How do you react to... We haven't had a lot of this news recently because of COVID, but pre-COVID, I think there was a huge conversation going around about transgender actors and actresses getting hired to do transgender roles, whether it be in movies or in theater.
Oh, it's still an issue. It's still an issue.
Oh, I know. But I think it was taking more of a national presence in terms of conversations, right?
There were a few big stars that, mm-hmm. that had been lined up to do trans parts, and you don't see that anymore. And you don't see it because basically... Since Hollywood still wants to do it their own way, by which I mean the white, cisgender, heterosexual, male way, they're just not going to have as many transgender parts. Mm. That's all there is to it, you know? If they're not going to trust that Alexandra Billings's and all the other, you know, proven transgender people, much less, you know, people like ourselves, that with one audition could prove to them that we might be able to be cast, if they're not going to leave their minds open for that, they're simply not going to have the transgender parts, because they know by now they will be boycotted. They will, you know, be on the wrong side of the cancel culture stick, as it were, mm-hmm. if they, you know, try to still do the Hollywood star system thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all that's changed, mm-hmm. is that they've just backed away from the whole thing. You know, and there are less transgender parts as a result of it, certainly less transgender lead roles. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's barely enough to keep Alexandra Billings, you know, and mm-hmm. a handful of other people busy. So that's sad. But it's changing. The 50-50 by 2020 group, mm-hmm. you know, that Joey Soloway has put together. The 50-50, of course, refers to a male-female balance, but the larger scope of his organization is to get full equity in terms of all gender identities, full representation, and all races as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that initiative will, I think, eventually be one of many, you know, that change the face of things. So, in the film industry.
How do we, because there's a lot of theater people who listen to my podcast, how do we in the theater community address these issues? How do we fight back?
First of all, if you're not 100% sure what transgender is and where we're coming from and what our needs are, ask. There are all across the country, you know, there are very intelligent transgender people with experience in the entertainment industry that will inform you. I do a bit of that, mostly right now in the Chicago area. And if you have any questions, come to me. I am actually the administrator of the largest transgender actor Facebook group in the world, international. And many of our members are not only actors, but they are also advocates, or that will work as consultants on set. So get the facts, basically. Also remember, secondly, that it's not just putting faces in there, it's getting our truth. And the truth really is best represented by this type of story that it is. Mm-hmm. We're not going to do what, unfortunately, so many other ethnicities or sexual preferences have had to do, and that's put up with 30 years of really crappy representation, just to have representation. Mm-hmm. We're not going to do it. Because our lives are at stake. I mean, if shows are always going to show us as the victim, you know, as tragic, as not being capable of having families and a healthy life, you know, which is the main trope for transgender characters, you know, the tragic and the marginalized. Well, as long as people keep portraying us as tragic and marginalized, that's the way we're going to be treated. You know, and that, so we're not going to stand for that. I have refused parts because it was of that ilk.
Yeah.
And I explain why, you know, and then there'd be some other trans actor that comes and say, oh God, you know, I'm sorry I had to read for this. I hope you don't hate me, but you know, I'm getting to be so old and this part is so good for me. I don't know if I'll have another chance. You know, which is in part of the thing, you know, I mean, acting jobs are scarce for all actors. For trans roles, for trans actors, holy moly, yeah, it can be or some pretty slim pickings. So standing your ground and educating theater and filmmakers as you go is seen as just too big a risk for some people. For me, I think it's too big a risk not to. I really do.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes I rub people the wrong way just by speaking up. I think I'm pretty good about, you know, how I discuss things. I tend not to yell and scream at people. I also tend to understand where they're coming from because I did not identify as any sort of a queer person until my mid-late 40s, much less as transgender.
Mm-hmm.
I know that it can be hard to get your mind around some of these concepts. But if you are going to accept the fact that we exist and that your gender identity, that basically the gender revolution is three things. Your gender identity can vary from your sexual identity. I don't mean your sexuality. I mean, just your genitals.
Yeah.
Your identity can vary from your genitals. And the other two things, you know, are that sexuality and gender are not necessarily the same thing. That just because you're transgender doesn't necessarily mean that you're gay or whatever. And also that everything exists on a spectrum. And this, I think, is the hardest thing because we have been bred as certainly this civilization, if not the entire species, has been bred to think in terms of binary. For a lot of things, and particularly for the whole male-female thing. But, you know, we don't live in a society where you have to identify a mate and reproduce and get that kid to a certain age before your 30th birthday because you're going to die. I mean, there's no need that we have to be stuck inside that survival binary that might have been fine for the African plains or necessary, you know, for the Siberian tundra. Yeah, we can go beyond that, and we are capable of that. But it's a big change, a big, big the thing that theaters wrestle with a lot is they'll say, okay, I understand you. I get you. As the artistic director, as the director, I'm just worried about our audiences. That if I put you in to, say, play a major female part that's used to being played by a cisgender female actor, let's just pull one here, let's say Blanche in Streetcar Named Desire. I'm just afraid that our audience won't buy you and that your presence in it will distance them from, you know, the story in a very unproductive way. So then you've got to start talking. And the way I address that is simply, you know, to say that, you know, we've existed from the very beginning. We've been a part of the world. And if you want to acknowledge that we're in the world the same way that you acknowledge, you know, that people of color are in the world, you know, and we've made progress in casting other ethnicities and races and traditionally white roles, then you also have to, you know, accept the fact that we are part of your world. And if you want the world on stage to look like the world outside your theater, you know, the reality, then at some point you're going to have to put us on that stage and trust the audience. You know? There are other ways. So much of it depends on the play. Some plays really lend themselves well to... I mean, even if I am, say, perceived as a man wearing a dress by some people, there are some plays that work good from that. You know, that aesthetic distance, that aesthetic perspective is not a bad thing. And for some other plays, you know, maybe I would be a distraction. I don't know. And there are ways to address things in terms of that, too.
Well, you're a distraction because you're so fabulous. I mean, I can't...
That was exactly the right answer.
Well, that was on it. That was one of the most beautiful things I think I've heard from a guest on this podcast. So thank you for sharing that. Last thing I'd love to ask you. I usually ask a lot of my guests this, if they had Joe Biden's ear, if you were able to kind of just wave a magic wand, get a meeting with Joe Biden and talk to him about some things that you would like to see moving forward. What are some things that you would tell him? What are some things that you would like to personally see?
Really, the things that are most pressing to me have nothing to do with gender identity, because he's making good progress on that. And he will support anything that the Congress, you know, actually does if there's additional legislation that's necessary. I think what needs to be done is we need to uncouple money from power. And that means eliminating or at least tightly regulating all lobbying. It means that we use a portion of our tax funds to pay for all elections. Now, of course, the media companies will fight this because they know they're not going to get nearly as much money out of the federal government, you know, for airtime or for apolitical ads as they were able to get out of these parties. But that's what we need. You cannot, you essentially can buy, if you can buy attention and buy media saturation in this world, this media world of ours, then you're basically buying the presidency. And that's not fair. That is not what our forefathers intended, as far as I can see. And they weren't nearly as egalitarian as we are. You know, they've pretty much felt that all men are created equal, you know, referred to like the upper third of, you know, white people, businessmen. And they would have been shocked by the kind of, you know, stuff that goes on in terms of favoritism and the lobbying situation. So that to me is the job one. Get money completely out of government. Term limits, particularly in the Congress, you know, it's 2 years for a reason. You know, to get turnover, you know, to have a nice fresh face in there for one or two terms and then get the heck out. And no, you know, you should not be a congressman for decades and decades and decades. You know, that's ridiculous. And then just to do whatever is necessary to take those words that, you know, all men are created equal, translate those into all men deserve equal opportunity. to realize who they are. Because we think that's implied in the words of the Constitution. Clearly it's not. Because we've had to have, how many laws have we had to put in to make sure that people of color are not disenfranchised in a number of different ways? That women are not disenfranchised. We still haven't got, you know, an Equal Rights Amendment. It's not in the Constitution, and we cannot assume that it's going to be there unless we and our leaders make sure that it's there. So those three things, I guess, would be the big stuff.
The big ones.
The three big ones.
Well, Delia, thank you again so much for joining us today. You have shared so many wonderful insights, and I cannot thank you enough. So thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me be a part of this. I really enjoyed your podcast. I love the conversations here. Thanks.
Thank you for listening.